This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 7th of February 2012. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour on Monocle 24. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Coming up over the next hour, we sit down in the London offices of one of the world's most celebrated architects, Lord Richard Rogers.
Architecture is political. There's no way you can avoid it. The ghettos which we build, be they the rich or the poor, more or less dictate or are part of the political situation.
We grab a caipirinha and don a bikini to get the skinny on Sao Paulo Fashion Week.
Streetwear design company Cavaleira used the railway bridges suspended over the metro station's platforms as a catwalk, while locals waited below to catch the metro.
And we sit down with Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, to talk through the design of the menswear Fashion Week invitations.
I think paper's a beautiful, beautiful material and it doesn't need to be messed around with as much as that, even if it is for a fashion house. And it needs to be glamorous and fabulous. I think it should be both those things, but elegant too.
That's all to come on this week's Section D. Stay tuned. Welcome to this week's edition of Section D. Last Tuesday, one of the world's greatest architects, Richard Rogers, took to the stage at London's Royal Institute of British Architects with his two partners, Graham Stirk and Ivan Harbour. It was the first time they'd spoken publicly on stage, and together they demystified the goings-on of their global award-winning practice. From projects past and present to revelations about the inner workings of their own firm and their thoughts on city life, the talk was a monumental lifting of the lid on an industry that's all too often seen as rather aloof. Keen to hear more, I scooted over to Lord Rogers' West London offices the next day to quiz him a little further on his extraordinary career.
You have a real talent for talking about architecture in very human terms, which is something that most architects lack. Is this something that you've sort of developed over the course of your career?
I certainly came as much into it as much on the political, social side as I did from the art side, shall we say. So I suppose it does come up really naturally to me. And the fact that I love cities and I was born in a wonderful city-state being Florence, you know, and London's fantastic and so on. That does drive you to realise the interrelationship between space and people.
But another point that you made in the talk, which I was interested by, was the fact that you said architects don't have a place at the table for...
Yes, that's where I'm putting it.
And you've been very vocal about how important architects are in shaping...
One's environment.
One's
yeah.
environment.
I think it mainly because, first of all, architects tend to concentrate on the more on the design side towards the beauty side, and I'm all for beauty, and not on the marriage between science and art, shall we say. And as far as politicians are concerned, they wouldn't have a clue when they get into the art side. So why do they want architects if they keep on concentrating, and if they believe they concentrate, not helped by the fact that the profession underlines this in a way by either doing very rather boring, sort of very technical studies, or doing art, but seldom marrying the two. And I think this is, and that, as I said at my talk, I believe architecture should actually is the mother of arts, and that there should be a sort of general course, which is architecture, three-dimensional architecture, 3 to 5 years, and then you should specialise in doing, whether it's planning or engineering, urban engineering, or whether it's landscape or what else.
So do you see it as a failing of the architecture industry then, that they haven't managed to translate the importance of what they do to the general
public
or policymakers?
I mean, no profession has got it right totally, let's put it that way. In the area that I was talking about them is that if I think architecture is political. There's no way you can avoid it. You have to get planning permission to start with. You're dealing with cities, which are a very political situation. You know, the ghettos which we build, be they the rich or the poor, more or less dictate or are part of the political situation, which are either brutal, which creates certain reactions of people. As you go into the poorer areas, people either vote extreme left or extreme right. And that's, you know, it creates polls. And that has its own problems. So it's very political. What it does to people is political. Politicians don't tend to recognise that.
You've obviously worked in thousands of cities around the world. Is there...
Thousands is overdoing it. Maybe 100.
Hundreds, very many anyway. Do you feel like one country gets it right in terms of the way that they treat the architecture?
I think you learn from different parts. I think Barcelona, for its 20 years of amazing, brilliant mayors, and Spain, after Franco, was a very liberal country and was very interested in culture, for instance. Therefore, you can see the Bilbao effect of a lot of very beautiful single buildings with actually fantastic tram and so on, or Barcelona with its immense achievements, especially along the seafront and so on. And they've done some brilliant developments. You can go to France and see, first of all, rather centralized decision making, but often by very good mayors, appointing good architects, planners, and so on. And of course, Mitterrand, and I have, you know, I'm a Pompidou product of the Pompidou Center, but I also was advisor to Mitterrand, who were very interested in. And now, we, one of our biggest jobs is for Sarkozy looking at the problems of Paris. I can't imagine any prime minister inviting architects to consider, or it's mixed teams, not just architects. I'm working with Arabs, engineers, with London School economics in Paris, but basically considering that to a critical part of their heritage and their politics. Sarkozy, invited us within 6 weeks of being elected. That is a different priority to what one tends to have in this country.
And when you look at what's happening in London at the moment, obviously huge developments going on in East London, and you made the point that, you know, the Olympics are only 2 weeks, it's what gets left there afterwards that's important.
Yes.
Do you feel that they're getting it right?
I think, again, I have to be careful because I worked heavily on the Olympics with Ken Livingstone, not so much on the Olympics really as a legacy, which is what interests me, that's the long-term situation. East London is one of the poorest parts of Western Europe, let alone of England. London is about as rich as you can get, and that's something that tells you something's wrong somewhere there. What I was, shall we say, suggesting, dreaming, that there may be a big switch, as there was in Berlin, between East and West. Everybody said West Berlin is it, and poor old East Berlin. Today, everybody, most people now want to be in East Berlin, and all the most elegant shops and best coffee stores and nightclubs, whatever it is, tend to be. So you've seen a revolution. I think that's also possible, because not only because of the Olympics, the legacy, but because of the development of Canary Wharf, because of Woolwich and Greenwich. You're seeing a whole new piece of city, and I think that will change, and there's a lot more potential for growth there. Potential not on brownfield, because it's all derelict. So it's very interesting what could go on there, and if we have the vision, political, social and architectural, we'll call it, then it could be the best part of London.
And the airport.
And the airport becomes, absolutely.
I also wanted to ask you about what you feel the role of the architect is today. I mean, you've had a career that's spanned
a long time. I've been very lucky, I have to quickly say.
But you've also been quite central in shaping sort of the changing role of the architect over that period. How do you think it's changed from when you started out to what it is today, really? Because it's not just about building buildings at all.
No, I think as far as, shall we say, Britain is concerned, there is an awakening. I think I may have said it, but you know, when I sort of started going to college, architecture was not considered practically a worthwhile thing to talk about, and certainly art wasn't either. It was very, apart from old art. I mean, the National Gallery was always wonderful, and the Tate, and I used to be the chairman of. 80% of the people went to see the old art, historic art, which is beautiful, but there's no recognition now in the last 20 years, and very much under the control of Nick Sirota, who's a brilliant curator, and the Tate Modern, Bankside, has exploded, not only just in terms of its size, but actually has created a doorway for artists to enter, and also inspired the public to go and visit. And in fact, I read only last month in the New Yorker a wonderful article saying, you know, London is the place for art. Wow, that's fantastic.
It's fantastic for art, but for architecture, bar a few monuments, do the public go and see buildings?
Yes.
Do you feel like the public understand architecture?
I don't know about the public, but there is a others who have been less fortunate than I, who have built mainly abroad, David Chipperfield, for instance. A very large amount of his work is abroad. And you have to say, well, why? I have nothing against going abroad. In fact, I like what's changed. We've suddenly been forced to realize that the Far East is actually the center of the world, where it used to be the States, and before that it could be Europe with Britain in the lead. This has all changed, and that's fine. Yeah, Britain has improved, and quality of life has improved immensely. And let's say that. Back to London, 20 years ago, it was very grey. There was nowhere to have a coffee, nobody used the sidewalks or pavements, except to go from A to B. Now, you just go through Covent Garden, Soho, wherever you like, and it's full of it, let alone on the South Bank. Full of vitality. One has to remember that until 20 years ago, the South Bank was a no-go area. Apart from that little bit of the festival hall, there was just about nothing on the South Bank, apart from derelict buildings. What a change. If I want to enjoy myself today, and especially have friends, we walk down on a weekend down on the South Bank, because there's an immense mixture of different people, different cultures, different ages. I love that, that whole mixture. Totally changing, having their festivals, be it Brazilian or wherever it may be, their festival, I like that. That's a vitality of the city.
You're endlessly vocal about your passion for cities and city life. So would it be hell for you to move to the countryside?
No, I enjoy all the more. The weekends I get away, not many, and I go and stay with one of my sons usually, who has a weekend house, and I love going. I spend a month in the summer in South Tuscany, actually in the countryside, beautiful valley and so on. So in one of my points is that if you design what I believe you should, or if you develop a compact city, then you have a countryside. If you don't, you just have a sprawl. And it's amazing how quickly you destroy the view. And there's nothing more exciting than going to see the rolling downs or the rolling hills or the lakes or the sea. But if you've got little houses or whatever it is, I've spotted all over, you've lost it. So my point is, it's two sides of the same coin, and we have to be as defensive of both.
That was me with Richard Rogers in his West London offices. You're listening to Section D. Time for a quick break, but stay tuned. We'll be hearing from the first of our fashion collaborators next.
For the latest Monocle news, previews on upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all of our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com.
When business is frugal and consumers are counting their pennies more carefully than ever, small fashion brands go one of two ways. They either sit tight and ride out the storm, or they take a punt and try something different. It's often the latter track that sees the greatest return. And Monocle's writer, Nelly Gocheva, dropped in on three such brands, each pushing the boat out and collaborating with a new partner to share experience and expertise and produce something altogether more interesting. First up, Nelly sat down with Tim Little, owner of Grenson, the heritage English shoe brand, which has recently been cozying up to Barber of waxed jacket fame.
We were first introduced to Barber via a retailer that we both sell to. And they said to us, you know, why didn't we get together with Barber? Because a little range of shoes between the two companies could be a really nice thing for their customers. So we got together with them, and I visited their factory up north, and they visited our factory, and we realized that there were two companies that were incredibly similar in many ways. We just made a different product, but we're both British companies. We both had a long heritage of manufacturing, and we just thought it would be a really nice thing to do, to be able to combine some of their knowledge and their skills and some of ours into a product that had both names equally on it, and also that a lot of our customers that we sell to are Barber customers as well. So it just seemed like a very neat fit and a very nice kind of different thing to do for the two companies.
Tim, let's talk more about the business side of fashion. Do you think that collaborations bring in more clients, higher sales and brand awareness?
I think it all depends on the collaboration. And I think every collaboration, it's obviously a big trend at the moment, collaborations, and people are doing hundreds of them everywhere, in fashion in particular. I think in some cases they're done for a reason of building sales, and in other cases they're done purely for the image and the story that comes from them, but not necessarily for sales. So sometimes, for example, you might do a collaboration that ends up being quite expensive on the final product because of certain materials that might be used or development costs of that particular type. But it won't result in big sales, but it's still very good for the image of the two brands if they feel, each brand feels it can get something from the association of the other brand. But in other cases, it can be enormous for sales. So, you know, some of the original, collaborations have been going on for over 100 years, but they've become a big marketing tool more recently. And some of the things like Kate Moss for Topshop, for example, are an example of where it creates incredibly high sales, and the reason for doing it is for sales purposes mainly.
Okay, then fashion-wise, what does it take to make a good collaboration? I mean, how would you select who to collaborate with, given that you still need to keep your brand identity? So in this case, as you said, Barber and Grenson, you're both British companies, heritage companies. So what would you advise?
Personally, I think the collaborations that make sense and have some kind of relevance are the ones where they're properly thought out, and it makes sense when you look at those two companies coming together to produce something. It makes sense, and you think, yeah, I can understand why those two companies coming together to produce a product might add value to them, the two companies individually. But I think, you know, collaborations can go way too far as well, and sometimes people are desperate for a story and they collaborate together and the collaborations just seem ridiculous. You know, ridiculous examples of two brands that mean nothing to each other at all, have no connection whatsoever. And then I think that's where it goes a little bit wrong. But, you know, for example, in the case of Grenson and Barber, I loved that one because they were two companies with very similar stories and very similar heritage, both manufacturing in the UK, and both bringing together their skills to make a product that was maybe even better than the two would have done individually. So it was a really relevant, nice story. Other collaborations, we do collaborations with smaller designer brands, for example, where what we get from it is we get the chance to work with somebody who has very creative, new, fresh ideas, and they come to our brand and to our factory with some whole fresh approach to what materials to use, what last to use, and eventually, you know, it kind of stimulates us creatively as well. Those can be a lot smaller than the Barber collaboration, but they're still relevant to us, I think, because it helps us in a design capacity.
Perfect, Tim. So are there any other new collaborations you're working on or planning in near future?
There are. The problem with collaborations is they tend to be quite secret until they're ready, because in their very nature they can be there's a lot of development work until you get to the point where you're certain you've got what you really want from it. We also, another part to this that's important to me is I like collaborations that make enough sense to keep them going. So we'll continue to work with Barber. We've been working with a big brand in America called Rag & Bone, who are very successful, and we've been working with them now for 4 years. We've been working with a company in the UK called Album, who are a big menswear chain of stores in London, who are also doing very well. We've been working with them for 3.5 years. So we've got a lot of ongoing collaborations that just work and continue to develop in a sensible way, and we've got some new ones in the pipeline that we're excited about.
That was Nelly Gochiva with Tim Little of Grenson Shoes. And we'll be hearing from two more brands throughout the show. But it's time now to hop across the Atlantic and hear how Sao Paulo's recent Fashion Week is trailing the blaze for Brazil's legion of homegrown talent. Our reporter in Sao Paulo, Sheena Rossiter, spent the week on the front row.
There's a constant buzz in the air as everyone here struts around Parque Ibirapuera's Bienal from one show to the next, as if the fashionable guests were on a catwalk of their own. Everyone is here to catch a glimpse of the latest fashion coming out of Latin America's largest city and its largest fashion week. At Sao Paulo Fashion Week's 32nd winter collection, 30 of Brazil's top designers have put their fall and winter collections on display during the five-day event. And naturally, like any fashion week, Sao Paulo too is peppered with celebrities, both Brazilian and international. The faces that attracted the most attention was supermodel Alexandra Ambrosio. At 4 months pregnant, the Victoria's Secret model hit the runway in Sunday night's closing show for Kolosi. Wearing several earth tone inspired looks that reflected winter in a southern hemisphere year-round summer feel, she walked the catwalk and waved to Hollywood actor Ashton Kutcher in the front row, who shared the runway with her at last year's event.
Para mim, estar aqui é sempre um enorme prazer.
That's Brazilian model and TV presenter Adriane Galisteo, who hosts the Brazilian version of Project Runway and who was in the front row at the Eodice show. She says she's proud to see how much Brazil has grown in the fashion world and its recent economic growth, and she is hoping it continues. But all the celebrity glitz and glam aside, what this year's Sao Paulo Fashion Week was really about was the unique mixture of fabrics and colors used by designers. One of the favorites of the week was Sao Paulo designer Alexandro Erkovitz, who presented both a men's and women's collection. Kate Sturd, senior events editor of WGSN, a London-based company that specializes in design and trend analysis, sat in on the Erkovitz show and explains how his designs make him stand out.
He has a really strong sensibility that works really well on a global basis. And as we've just seen, he's always pushing boundaries with playing with the new kind of fabric development that we're seeing in the market at the moment, play on the colours, and also those kind of 60s influences that are coming through.
Having used materials that range from mesh to metallic leather to cashmere in his designs, Erkovich's retro-infused 2012 fall and winter collection was one of the week's highlights, as its designs took a look from the past and fused it with contemporary new use of fabrics. As Kate points out, this was the common thread that ran through most looks at this year's Fashion Week.
I think it's really interesting the way that we're seeing designers play with fabrics. I know we've had a lot of prominence of colour, but going forward, I think the customer, especially in a time of kind of uncertainty and almost people, well, globally, maybe not so much in Brazil, but wanting more value for what they're getting and more of a narrative behind products, we're seeing people and designers play with more fabrics. And it's the double-faced fabrics, it's the bonded fabrics, it's kind of things that maybe seem a bit eccentric on a commercial level. But those plastics that we just saw at Herkovich, and also the contrast between the heavy autumn fabrics and the lace lightweight and layers and sheers that looks new, I think, for autumn.
On the other side of the city, at Estação da Luz, streetwear design company Cavaleira used the railway bridges suspended over the metro station's platforms as a catwalk, while locals waited below to catch the metro. This show, which has a total of 46 looks, with about half being men's and half being women's, is one of the highlights of the week, as the show's untraditional setting helps bring the clothes to life. Dominated by street design that plays on styles from the countryside and mixes them with an urban feel, this season's designs were all complemented by black hats, either the traditional trucker or cowboy hats that were decorated with feathers. And black was the dominant theme, as one of Cavaleira's designers, Fabiano Grassi, explains.
Cavaleira is from São Paulo, so it's the biggest city in the country. There's a lot of black here, a lot of gray, a lot of bottle boys, you know that. So that's our universe. It belongs to rock and roll also. It's a rock and roll brand. That's why so much black. We always have black. And it's very young also. So we have color, we have prints, very colorful. But every season, every collection, we keep showing black because it belongs to the to the brand.
And Fabiano also tells how Cavalera used an interesting mix of materials this season.
Again, we come back to the cities, a sort of collage. So that's why a lot of materials. We have wool, then we have some cottons with fake leather, some with more rubber touch, leather touch. Then we have sort of really light cottons underneath. Fleece is very important for us, like a street uniform also. For winter, then we choose a military green and then a khaki.
This is a fabric.
Rounding off the last day of Sao Paulo Fashion Week is another favorite, designer Fernanda Yamamoto. This is her fourth show at Sao Paulo Fashion Week, and her designs are known to incorporate handmade fabrics and beading techniques, as she explains when she gave me a preview of her collection at her Villa Maddalena-based store a few weeks before the show.
In all my collections, I always use some handmade techniques or embroideries or like making fabrics here. It's all handmade and it's a long process, like exclusive clothes. In the previous collection, I used embroidery, and the previous collection I brought some fabrics, like hand-tied fabrics I brought from Japan. For the next collection I will continue with this work. It's kind of it's a felting process that we do here, and we are still using this with merino wool and silk.
This season she is using a felting technique that is common in Chile in some of her designs, but with a contemporary twist. With a rose-colored silk fabric as a base, lime green, orange, and navy blue felt fabrics are woven over top of the silk to give this blazer a check-like print. Just part of several handmade looks Fernanda has created, all of which took plenty of time and patience to create.
This feels like a very different type of fabric.
This is all artisanal made here. So for every meter of the, to make this, it takes about three to four hours.
Just to make the fabric.
The silk and the merino, the fibers go into the silk with just water, hot water and soap and friction. This is a very old and very traditional technique. I think I use in a different way, contemporary way.
As yet another Sao Paulo Fashion Week comes to a close, innovative designs using interesting mixtures of fabrics are likely to keep the fashion world's attention on Brazilian designers. For Monaco, in Sao Paulo, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Time to hear from our second collaborator now. Next up, Nelly Gochiva joined Larry Lee, founder of LA eyewear brand Oliver Peoples. He's teaming up with Takahiro Miyashita, a young Tokyo-based fashion brand, for a bit of creative commingling.
The recent collaboration with Takahiro Miyashita, a local Japanese designer who's quite respected in Japan, he formerly had a collection in a retail store called Number 9 back several years ago, and I recall. But recently he developed the brand called The Soloist, so he's more known as The Soloist now. His brand is distributed into very selective stores around the world, in Japan, the boutiques, in New York, and in Europe, you know, Colette and Dover Street Market, and stores alike like that around the world. So it's very limited, very exclusive, very special, high quality. But a couple of years ago, he had come to our partners in Japan who are pretty much represent all of Oliver Peoples with a retail store there of Oliver Peoples, and they distribute our brand throughout Asia and Japan. They called them and they wanted to get together with us and talk design and talk to collaboration. So we liked the idea of doing something with him. We liked the idea of what it can do for the Japan market, which there was a huge following for him and a great, you know, it was just a great area to have this be effective. So we met with him. He has a very big following in Asia, as we do too. And the collaboration felt like a great fit, and we called it the Oliver Peoples for the Soloist. The frames, what was interesting is the idea that was conceived there was to come up with this sort of salvage philosophy where it was important to him that we don't create anything new as far as materials. It was sort of like the middle of the recession. Let's not like waste things. Let's not make new acetate plastics. Let's do something different, and let's look in the archives of bits and pieces and parts to frames from and tools that were made for patterns, for lens patterns and frame details and hinges and temples and fronts, which was a really fun, fresh project because it was really fun to look at that. It was just exciting. And we went through all of this, even the old factories, warehouses, and all the different things. And we were going to design this collection of frames that was using parts and pieces that we loved from before and figuring out how to be creatively use them into a frame and another frame and another frame. So a few frames. And we ended up with a small collection, which was launched last spring. And many of the things we found were like gold mines. I mean, they were just like, whoa, I remember this, remember that. You know, it's just really amazing. It was like anything, like looking at old watches and finding dials and things. So it was a really, I think that got a lot of attention in the press and stuff because of the thought of doing it that way, you know, and so not creating new toolings. And so the designs were infused with his styling and his kind of sense of style and Oliver Peoples. They were really a great fit, and anybody who looked at him really could tell that they fit our DNA, and they could tell that it totally fit his. So it felt like it was a rebirth of luxury eyewear for us. And the finished product is really a masterpiece of old and new, vintage and vintage inspired, and maybe modern, you know. We decided that we would launch also a very limited amount. There, you know, so it was really focused around the Japan market, and there were a lot of blogs and a lot of people following it, asking about it. Where do I get it in this and that? So it did what we expected, and it caused a big buzz. They sold totally out in Japan, mm-hmm. like within 2 months of that first collection. All gone. We're talking to them about the next collection. So this could be, you know, two or three collections that are going to come out within the rest of the year.
Let's yeah, it's not just one-time thing.
No, okay. It was successful. It was fun. It's exclusive, hard to get. People are begging for them. Now you can't buy them. So now you got to go find a way to get them, you know. So, and that's exactly what we wanted. So it just makes it really exclusive. And there's a huge amount of people who really love something they can cherish and special and keep forever and never goes out of style. It's just one of those things, the value goes up. It's like art, really, kind of.
Obviously, this particular collaboration's been a commercial and marketing success for you. What's your take on fashion collabs, generally speaking?
Well, you know, it's been going on for a while now. It feels like 4 years or so. And I remember when they first came out, you had to take a good look at yourself and your company and decide whether or not, you know, you should consider this. But for what reasons were you considering it? Because everybody was doing it or whatever. So I felt like in the beginning, there were some good collaborations around the world, not only in, you know, eyewear, but in clothing and shoes, sneakers, Nike, and all these different things. There were some that were really good that caused a lot of buzz, and they caused people to want to see what, for example, let's say Jay-Z and Kanye West would, what would they arrive at if they collaborated together on an album, which they just did. I mean, things like that. When you have two names and you can tell it's authentic and you have, and they're two artists and they have strong opinions and you're kind of anxious to see how they perform together, you know, it could cause a lot of interest. But I think a lot of them got out of hand, and you can see a lot of them that had no real meaning or care or just nothing. It's just like they put two names together and there was just bam, you know, it got like abused, if you know what I mean. It just felt like, oh, this got to go away. Kind of like reality TV many years ago. There was a little bit of it, and people were talking in the newspapers. It'll go away. Weirdly, it came back even stronger.
Exactly. So in this sense, what does it take to make a good collaboration? And how do you manage to keep your brand identity in a collaboration with another brand? How do you select the best designer to collaborate with?
I think after the years it's been going on, I think it is still a really important thing. And now it's more important that the collaborations really make sense, that they put people together that have a clear direction, pinion, authentic style, and have the same kind of goals, you know, of creating something that's respected, you know, that has meaning, that know their audience, and that their audience will really appreciate it, you know. So if you can achieve that, and you get people going everywhere to get these frames or talking about it, you've succeeded.
That was Nelly Gochiva talking to Larry Lee in LA. Time for a quick break, but stay tuned. We're rifling through the recent men's fashion show invitations with the expert eye of Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, next.
Every month, Monocle deploys over 70 writers and photographers to over 50 countries to deliver our print edition. Covering a unique mix of global affairs, business, culture and design, Monocle publishes 10 magazine editions a year and 2 special newspapers during the summer and winter holiday seasons. With a subscription to Monocle, you'll not only be the first to receive the magazine, you'll also be invited to special events and receive our iconic tote bag from Rutote of Japan. Subscribe to Monocle from £80 sterling at our website at shop.monocle.com/subscriptions. Subscribe to Monocle and keep an eye on the world.
We're told to never judge a book by its cover, but can you judge a fashion show by its invitation? Our team recently returned from the men's autumn-winter 2012 menswear collections with a fistful of intricately designed invitations. From feathers to pop-ups to a myriad different printing techniques, I sat down with Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, to pull them apart.
Well, first of all, I felt very popular this morning when I arrived at work and had 50 invites on my desk. And then I realised they were actually to other people and...
I'm sorry, I should have put a note on there as well.
But then I read my email and I understood. What do I make of them? Mixed bag, really. There's certainly some interesting print techniques and choices of paper. The invites seem to be getting bigger and bigger, which is one thing I'm not sure I agree with.
I mean, I suppose it's something to do with the fact that people receive so many invitations now. And in amongst the invitations, there's a million press releases that land on people's desks every day. So in order to stand out from the crowd, it has to be something big and bold.
Yes, but unfortunately sometimes it's a bit too sort of bombastic. But you do have to get people's attention. And people are going about that various ways. It seems that the paper stock is becoming closer to wood. I mean, it's very heavy now. It's sort of...
You're holding Gucci then?
I'm holding Gucci, which is splendidly gold and shiny. It's one of my favourites of the pick, actually. But I think there's print techniques and foils, and some people are doing it well and some people are doing it badly. Churches is a very nice one, actually. It's very simple, very elegant. I think part of the problem with fashion houses is it's seasonal. They have to reinvent themselves constantly, and therefore they probably reapproach their graphic guidelines probably more often than they should. I think the simple, elegant ones are the best. That maxim applies to so many things so often, but especially in design. Another star of the show, I think, probably the favourite, although it is a bit of a gimmick, which I don't normally go for, but Louis Vuitton done quite a nice take on the globe where you open the invite and there's an Eiffel Tower assembles and
it's
clicks
amazing.
Together with magnets. I don't know if you think,
let's hear that mic, click again.
I don't know if the mic will pick that up, but as it comes together, it's a nice little bit of 3D work. And
you see, I do love a gimmick from time to time, and that is something that I would probably hold on to, which presumably is the ultimate goal behind the brands, that they create something that isn't just a piece of paper that you flick in your bag and then throw out as soon as you've been to the show, but something that sort of carries forward the brand's principles and maybe even that collection into paper form.
Yeah, I think you want to covet it, you want to keep it, you want to pin it on your notice board at work. Surprising lack of photography, given that these brands have access to the sort of the most beautiful girls in the world and the best photographers and all this kind of retouched imagery and the fabrics and the collections themselves. Obviously, they can't give too much away, but I'm surprised that they don't act more as teasers as to what's to come. They're not particularly enticing. They do rely solely on on the name of the actual brand itself, which if you're an Italian powerhouse fashion company, then that's all well and good. But I think from a design point of view, it'd be nice just to have a little bit more, maybe a little bit more skin on display.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And something, I mean, you've designed countless invitations in your time and you can probably look at these in a way that most people who receive them won't, in that you know a good print from a bad print. Do you feel that just from looking at them, you can get a sense of the fashion houses that are maybe trying to cut costs a little bit, doing something that I don't want any names. I don't think it's really fair to name names, but there are some that have probably used a cheap technique to...
Yeah, there's a technique called copper plate, which is commonly known as engraving. And I'm glad to say Burberry have used that and employed it very nicely on a nice classic bit of white paper. It's expensive. It's old. I mean, there's very few places that do it. And they have done it, so credit to them. It's, you know, they're displaying their luxurious quality. There's a cheaper version called thermographing, which is a kind of vending machine business card type of print technique.
You can have it done in the airport, can you?
Yeah, it's a little bit estate agent. And there's a few of them that have used that, which I think is, I don't think it's for cutting costs. I think it's just a little bit of lack of knowledge on the designer's part. They've just gone for a cheap technique. But unfortunately, I mean, I don't feel you need a trained eye to spot it. I think it just looks cheap.
Will you give me one so that I can have a look?
Yes,
see.
It looks like a bit of sort of cheap moulded plastic, actually. There we are. It's what happens is the ink becomes, it gets baked onto the paper and it becomes raised and shiny. And
yes, and this is something that I used to do when I was a child, and you would sprinkle plastic on and then heat it up and
yes,
it would melt.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Okay, now I do see we should steer clear of thermoplastic moulding.
I think so, yeah.
There's another one that's quite intriguing with feathers sticking out the top of it, and certainly for novelty value.
For novelty value, it wins hands down. It's also, I mean, technically it's two pieces of board with a kind of bronze glittery surface ink. And, yeah, for...
Thumbs up, thumbs down?
Thumbs up for original thought, but perhaps thumbs down for gaudy piece of print. Sorry to be a snob, but I think paper's a beautiful, beautiful material, and it doesn't need to be messed around with as much as that, even if it is for a fashion house, and it needs to be glamorous and fabulous. I think it should be both those things, but elegant too.
That was Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, dispensing his well-honed eye over the recent menswear show invitations. Fashion brands, take note. And for anyone who wasn't invited, here's one of my favourite songs to drown your sorrows. This is Uninvited, the unplugged version, by the wonderful Alanis Morissette. That was Alanis Morissette with Uninvited. And returning to our fashion theme, it's time for the third of our creative collaborators. This time, Nelly Gochiva spoke with Joseph Quartana, founder and creator of Six Sense Perfumes in New York. He recently unveiled a collaboration with six up-and-coming fashion designers, tasking them to sniff out their own signature fragrance.
How did you come up with the idea of Six Sense?
Fundamentally, the project is actually a charity project. We give a few percentage points of our revenues to a deserving charity for each, you know, series that we put out. And my partner, Kaya, who's the creative director, and I had done a few charity events together in New York. So it kind of was born of that. Kaya was doing some work for the perfume giant Coty years back. And, you know, I have a fashion boutique. And he came up with the idea of doing a limited edition series of fragrances, and we were like, well, how could we make it interesting? And it, of course, it would be for charity. And I suggested that, you know, we, you know, select, you know, up-and-coming designers to do to render their visions through scents, because no one's done that before. So it sort of was born out of that. And it started as this little side project where we just pulled together, you know, a few thousand dollars each, and now it's grown into this, like, this big monster. So we have to treat it like a proper corporation these days. But it's been, you know, it's been quite a journey.
So how do you select the designers? Can you just tell me more about them and also the perfumers? Is it easy to get designers and perfumers involved with a project?
Sure. Okay. So basically, fundamentally what we do is we pair visionary designers with accomplished perfumers. So, and we want the, you know, these visionary designers to render their design aesthetic through fragrance. The new medium for them to explore. So I try to select designers that I feel are influential enough in the fashion industry that they should have a fragrance, but they're not necessarily big enough yet that they can have a fragrance. So by pairing six together, we can reach like factory minimums and stuff and make it happen. So designers I choose basically, well, I try to have a geographic balance. So I'll pick from the most dynamic sort of fashion markets. So, you know, there'll be like, let's say, one New Yorker, there will be one Brit, there will be one Central European, one Asian, like Far Eastern Asian, and, you know, we've also, you know, sourced from Scandinavia in the past. So we try to keep it geographically balanced that way. So, you know, it's not like, let's say, three Americans and three British, you know, because we sell all over the world, so we want to have this kind of balance. And we look for designers that, you know, it's the prerequisites are they have to own their own aesthetic and be quite visionary and recognized for it. They have to have done a few runway shows. And, yeah, they just have to be, like, really, really fascinating. Because the more interesting they are and the more radical and far out their vision is, the more interesting the fragrance is in the end, what we've noticed. So, and that's what we're trying to do is really redefine fragrance and come up with, you know, new formulas that no one's ever smelled before. So,
okay, so you just mentioned that you're trying to keep it internationally diversified. Do you think that this is your main secret of success, commercially speaking?
I think it factors in. I don't know if that's like the be-all, end-all prerequisite necessary for success in a collaboration, but it definitely makes it more interesting. And then you'd be surprised, you know, like different parts of the world, like different types of fragrances, you know, do better than others. So, I mean, for us also, it's a way of sort of hedging our bet to make sure that they all sell in the end, you know. I think, you know, really fundamentally, I believe that the secret of how we've done, you know, well so far is basically by choosing these very visionary designers. It all really boils down to what they envision in the beginning, and, you know, they really think outside of the box and then challenge the perfumers. It's really more about that, I would say.
So what does it, in your opinion, what does it take to make a good collaboration? Good in the sense of not just creating a stylish new product, but also being commercially successful?
Well, I think it starts with the right inspiration, you know, and that's what the designer brings to the table. But then as well, and equally as important, you know, you need someone that can actually render it, you know, that understands all the possible ingredients that you can select from and how they mix and what's sort of harmonious to the nose, what hasn't been done before, et cetera, et cetera. Like, we pair with Givaudan, that's our perfume partner, and they give us some of their most accomplished perfumers. And the laboratory, they can choose from, like, over 60,000 different ingredients. It's crazy. So, you know, the sky's the limit in that regard. And further, I mean, I think that in order to be successful, I think that there's two types of people in the market these days. There's someone who wants uniqueness and individuality, and then on the flip side, there's people that want safe, you know, safe choices to go, sort of go with the herd and whatnot. And I believe that the people that want the safe choices have some sort of social malaise along the lines of, like, there being too many choices out there, so they just want to default to something simple. We try to appeal to those who want to express their individuality. So they want something that's totally unique, totally different. They're not going to show up at a party and someone else is wearing the same fragrance as them, for example. So I think it's about that.
So in the end of the day, it's all about creativity mixed with a really good quality.
Exactly. I believe that's the wave of the future. People want choice, and that's what we're trying to give them.
And finally, Joseph, can you think of a recent collaboration that you liked, besides your own, of course?
Yeah, I'm always a fan of what Linda Farrow is doing. Mm-hmm. They're a sunglasses brand that's based in the UK, and they're quite similar to Sixth Sense in that they choose, you know, young, interesting, cutting-edge designers and, you know, basically do sunglasses for them. And I just saw them in Paris like 2 weeks ago, and they were showing me some of the newer styles. And there's one Spanish menswear designer named Boris Bajan Saleri who did a sunglass collaboration with them, and I just thought it was one of the coolest things I've ever seen, and I want a pair. So off the top of my head, I would say some of these sunglass collaborations have been knocking my socks off lately. So kudos to the Linda Farrow crew.
That was Nelly Gochiva with Joseph Quartana of Sixth Sense Perfumes in New York. Today's Section D was produced by Gillian DeBias. Our researcher was Thea Erdl, and our editor was Holly Fisher. Next week, we're heading north to Stockholm to bring you the brightest news from the annual Stockholm Furniture Fair. I'll be packing my snow boots and heading to the Swedish capital to check in with Scandinavia's latest and greatest designers and manufacturers. So be sure to tune in then. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Thank you for listening.